How can you wake up, slow down, and non-violently resist busyness? That's what we're going to explore today on Your Life in Process. I want to say thank you so much to those of you that are More Life in Process members. Thank you for supporting this show. And when you are a More Life in Process member, you get some special things for being part of the membership. This week, I have something very special for you. My 10-year-old son started leading us in these little short 5-6 minute meditations based on what he learned at Plum Village. And I asked him if he'd be willing to record one for your kids. He was super excited about it, and he may record more, so stay tuned for that. But he has recorded a meditation for your kiddos. This is a 10-year-old leading your kids in a 5-6 minute meditation on gratitude and love. It's super sweet. I'm going to upload it to the More Life in Process membership for you all, and I hope that you enjoy my little guy and that your kids can start meditating. It's possible, folks, so try it out. 5 minutes, they can do it. I also want to say that the workshop that I'm doing with Joseph Sofroci on process-based therapy has been moved. We've pushed it out to September. I am grateful for that. Any little bit of space is good for me in my life. So I will give you an update on that as it approaches, that 1 hour workshop. But I am here in August doing ACT for Eating and Body Image Concerns with Pessy. So join me for that full day online on demand workshop. And we will be talking about embodiment and mindful eating, of course, and interoceptive awareness and appetite awareness, as well as the ACT processes and relationship to body image and eating. So I hope you join me if you are a clinician. All right, enjoy this episode. Hey, this is Diana Hill. I'm your psychological flexibility guide. I hope that you see this podcast as a place where you get to learn about practices from contemplative wisdom and practices from modern psychology and see how they intersect and overlap, and then see how you can actually do them in your life. What does it look like today to live out these processes of living well? And I'm going to be doing that with you today by looking at 6 lessons that I learned while on retreat at Plum Village Monastery in France. It is nutso to take a 10-year-old and 13-year-old boy to a Buddhist monastery. And I guess we're kind of nuts like that. We first took our kids to Plum Village last year, and it was motivated by the pandemic, like seeing that life is short. And if we're going to do stuff that we've been talking about doing all this time, we better start doing it like now. I'd first traveled to Plum Village with my mom in 2000. I was 20 years old. I'm giving away my age here. I was 20 years old. My partner and I were just dating, and my parents had been longtime practitioners of Thich Nhat Hanh's work and had gone there a number of times. And my mom said, let's go. And you know, when you're in your 20s, you do stuff like that. But put a few more years, a few more decades on me, I'd gotten stuck in my ways and said, oh, this is a place I want to go. This is a place I want to go. We should bring our kids. And it really wasn't until the pandemic that motivated us. But once we went, it became clear to us, this is the medicine that our family needed. I'm going to talk about what that medicine is and how you can take that medicine without going to Plum Village. You don't have to go to France or to a monastery or be a Buddhist to be able to practice some of these processes and skills in your life. In fact, I really see the contemplative teachings that I offer here as secular. So I want to say that first and foremost, even though I'm going to be talking about a Buddhist monastery, the type of engaged Buddhism that Thich Nhat Hanh taught was very much applied to the West, and he really designed it in a way where you don't have to chant in Sanskrit or know Pali or believe in reincarnation to do this stuff. So Plum Village was developed 40 years ago. It's in the south of France, and it sits in the countryside of the Bordeaux region where it's surrounded by vineyards and sunflower fields. It kind of is the most idealistic setting you can imagine, and it is an operating monastery. And in the summers, they open up their monastery to families to come. And families come from all around the world. We met people from India and Colombia and England, all over France, Vietnam. It's a very international village, and the monastics are also quite international as well. So there's all these languages being spoken, and you can, and they have headphones for people. So the Dharma talks are done in English and Spanish and Italian and Vietnamese, and you can listen to it in your own language. So the first teaching that I wanted to share with you that you can apply right here, right now in your life is the teaching that It's a path, not a pill. Now, I heard this line from Brother Fapu on his podcast. He's the abbot of Plum Village, and he has a great podcast called The Way Out Is In. He said, it's a path, not a pill. And then Shantam Seth also said it on this podcast when I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. But this concept of being on a path in your life is really refreshing because we are bombarded with pills. We're bombarded with things that are designed to make our pain go away. And one of the very first principles of ACT when you become an ACT therapist is the principle that I'm not here to get rid of symptoms if you're an ACT therapist. I'm here to help you be able to navigate life with its symptoms. That we're all going to experience anxiety. We're all going to experience low moods. We're all going to experience loss. We're all going to experience conflict in our relationships. And the path is, what do you do when those things show up? The pill is, how do I get rid of those things? And it doesn't really give you a long-term solution, whereas a path does. I'd mentioned that retreats don't get rid of your stuff. Actually, your stuff just, you actually just have more clarity to see your stuff. And my husband and I actually got in one of the biggest fights that we have gotten into in a long time about midway through the retreat. And it was like one of those blowouts where we went through the first reaction of anger, and then we went into stonewalling, and then we went into I'm right and you're wrong. It was sort of like the worst behavior that I've seen in myself in a long time. But here's what was different. Because we were at Plum Village and because we're engaging in this practice, even while we were fighting, I had a knowing there is a path. I'm just not seeing it right now. I'm just not doing it. But I know that there's a path. There's a path to being an effective communicator in a relationship. There's a path to being more compassionate towards myself. There's a path towards listening deeply to what he's saying and having more a sense of understanding. And we found our way back to that path. That's the good news. When you have paths, whether they're paths for you to follow, like your eating plan, how do you want to eat? And you know for yourself that there's a path. There's certain ways of eating that work for you. There's certain ways of eating that don't work for you. You know when you're off the path, when you know when you're on the path. Not that there's rules, but rather there's knowings, right? There's a path in your relationships, ways you want to be with other people, with your friends, with your partner, with your parents. There's a path of communication, a path of being more direct, a path of boundary setting that you know works for you. And there are spiritual paths that resonate with you, right? These aren't pills. These are paths. So one of the books that I've been reading this summer, and I actually read it twice because I loved it so much, is Stephen Batchelor, his book, Buddhism Without Beliefs. And in the book, he talks about paths as having these three components to them. He says that a path gives you direction. When you come across a path in the woods, say you were lost and you didn't know where you were going, and you see this clearing, right? You'll have relief. You'll have a sense of, oh, I know that there's a direction that I could follow here that could get me to where I want to go. Direction. I hope that this podcast is a path for you and that we're carving out this path together to give you a direction towards what it means for you to live a well-lived life. Some of that direction may be something like the ACT core processes. If I know these six things, practicing acceptance, practicing knowing my values, practicing committed action towards my values-based goals, practicing being present, practicing perspective-taking sense of self, practicing diffusing my thoughts. When I practice these things, they're a path, right? They give you a direction to follow. So whether it's your psychological principles that you're practicing, or it's your eating principles, or your movement principles, or your spiritual principles, they're a path. They give you relief because there's a direction that you're headed. The second thing that Stephen Batchelor talks about in terms of paths is that they give you freedom to move. So if you think about a path as being a clearing, you know, there's a clearing in the brush, or a clearing of rocks, or a clearing of the forest. There is space for you to move along that path and flexibly move along that path. And that's something that's really important to me because I've had rigid paths that I've followed. And I imagine that you've been stuck in rigid paths, whether there are rigid belief systems about this is how you should live your life, or even rigidity in your spiritual practice, or rigidity in work settings. When you have a clear path, you also have clarity that it doesn't have to look a certain way and that you're figuring it out as you go. There's freedom to move within your path. And we know from psychology research, when you look at something like Desi and Ryan's research on self-determination theory, one of the things that really motivates us as humans is autonomy. So the freedom to move, the freedom to have agency, that this is your choice to take this path. So you can think about that for yourself. Where do you need a little bit more wiggle room, a little more freedom to move in the paths of your life? And then the third aspect that Stephen Batchelor talks about in terms of a path is that they help you feel like you're not alone. So again, imagine you're lost in the forest and you come across a path. Just the fact that you came across a path means that someone else has been there. Someone else has walked in front of you and you're not alone. There's a community that you are part of. You can think about the different communities of your life that help you with a path. Maybe it's a parenting community that helps you with the path of parenting. Maybe it's a movement community that motivates you to move more. Maybe it's a community of activism that you feel a sense of, wow, someone has been there before me and therefore I'm stronger because of it. They've carved the way. It gives us gratitude to think about the community and the people before us on our paths. And another aspect of it is as you walk the path, you are creating the path for others. The best way to maintain a trail is to walk a trail, right? You're carving it out as you go. And you can think about that in terms of what legacy you're leaving behind in your paths. So these three components of it being a path, not a pill, a component of it giving you direction, of giving freedom to move, and a sense of community are really important when you think about your life and the different domains of your life that are important to you. Do you have a sense of being on a path in those different domains? Do you have a sense of being on a path in your domain of work, in your domain of friendship, in your domain of relationships, in your domain of your own inner psychology, in the domain of your creativity, in the domain of your movement and your eating, on all the different domains of your life? What are your paths that you want to be following that give you direction, that give you flexibility, and that help you feel like you're not alone? So for me, Thich Nhat Hanh and the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh have been this really long lineage because my parents passed it on to me. And then I kind of made it my own, right? So I don't practice in the same way that my dad practices or that my family practices, but we've made it our own. And then passing it on to our children, encouraging them to make it their own. One of the things that happened when we got there is I was expecting this really lovely, cozy family time like we had last year. But in the teen program at Plum Village, they take the teenagers and they go camp with them completely separate from the other families. I only saw my son like one or two times really briefly during the week that we were on retreat. And it activated this feeling in me of the transition that I'm in my life right now. And the sadness of letting go of my son and letting him go off and do his own thing. And then also the joy of that, of seeing that he could do that. He meditated every morning at 7 a.m. on the porch outside of Thich Nhat Hanh's home. So here's my little guy learning how to meditate in one of probably the most spiritually, energetically profound places to learn. But he was off. He was off. And that is impermanence. Everything is changing and our expectations for things to be the same will create our misery, right? But when you have a path, do you know what to do with those feelings that come up for you? When you have a spiritual path or when you have a wellness path, you know what to do when the hardship strikes. A pill doesn't quite solve that problem. Having mental health struggles is not abnormal. And part of having a path is to help you when those mental health struggles inevitably show up in your life. So look for the path, not the pill. The second lesson that I want to share with you from Plum Village is a lesson to wake up and to take a look at what you are waking up to. Literally, what are you waking up to every morning? And figuratively, what is it that you want to wake up to in your life? So I had this incredible opportunity to go into Thich Nhat Hanh's home, his hermitage. It's more of like a hut. It's actually not that far off in size and design as this little office that I podcast from. Brother Vapu and I did an episode for this podcast there. We recorded it at Thich Nhat Hanh's kitchen table. And that will be out next week. I can't wait to share it with you. And in that interview. I'll also, on the YouTube channel, I'll share with you images from the space. He didn't want me recording video in the space, but he did let me take pictures. So when you walk into Thich Nhat Hanh's little hut, it's just a two-room little hut. There's a bedroom and basically a little kitchen area. And the first thing that I noticed was the view. It was an incredible view of big puffy clouds and rolling hills and the green French countryside. Everything looks green compared to summer in California. And part of the reason why that view popped was because inside, all the hues were brown. It's a very simple space. There was a simple platform bed, single bed. There was a coat hanger with Thich Nhat Hanh's coat and his brown robes. His three pairs of shoes were lined up next to a bookshelf, two pairs of sandals and one pair of clogs. These are shoes that I remember seeing him walking in, and I've seen pictures of him walking in. So it was pretty phenomenal to see those shoes in his space. And then his little bookshelf, which was made of blocks and, you know, pieces of wood. And in the bookshelf, it had dictionaries, a lot of books that were written in Vietnamese, so I didn't understand what the titles were. And then it had The Life of Pooh, The Life of Winnie the Pooh on his bookshelf, this little child that's in him. And one of the things that Brother Phat Phu said to me when I entered that space and commented on the view was, this is what Thay said was his television, looking out at this view. I imagined what it would have been like to wake up in this room in the morning, to have this combination of living so simply and so close to the earth and really only using what you need, to the degree that the outdoor vibrancy of the world just pops. And for many of us, what we are waking up to is not the vibrancy of life that's here. We're waking up to the overstimulation of our phones, of our thoughts, of our spaces, so that we don't actually see what's right before our eyes. So consider that for yourself. When you wake up in the morning, what are you waking up to? Are you waking up to a cluttered space? Are you waking up to your phone? Are you waking up to your own cluttered mind? And how do you want to wake up in your day? What do you want to be focused on and waking up to? And creating a space, creating a wake up, this time in the morning and actually the time in the evening are very important times. Alyssa Epple had talked to me about this in a personal conversation about how she's doing more research and interested in the morning time and the evening time, because those are particularly malleable times to work on our nervous system and our stress system. And particularly, we're open, you know, in that waking up time. So when you wake up, what are you looking at? And what do you want to wake up to? What's on your TV? And building that into your life so that maybe the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning is not pick up your phone, but is acknowledge the person that's in the bed next to you. Or maybe the first thing you do in the morning is not pick up your phone, but say some kind of vow. Thich Nhat Hanh is well known for the vow. Waking up, I smile, 24 brand new hours before me. I vow to live with compassion. So waking up. And part of that waking up is also seeing the benefits of our natural environment for our own mood and our well-being. There has been plenty of research, even dating back to a really classic 1981 study, where they reviewed medical records of people who were recovering from surgery. And all things being equal, the patients with bedside windows looking out on leafy trees healed on average a day faster and needed less pain medication than those that were looking at a brick wall. That research has been extended to just the idea that spending time in nature helps with your mood. You're more motivated to exercise if you're exercising in green spaces. You have a better mental restoration when you're in nature. You can go back and listen to the episode I did with Elizabeth Rucker on biohacking and how moving in nature boosts our creativity. It helps your eye health. If you are looking out at the horizon, looking at things far away, we spend so much time looking at screens close up that it's contributing to our short-sightedness, both mental short-sightedness and physical short-sightedness. So as we began to slow down at Plum Village and we were off of our technology, off of our phones for the time that we were there, the world became more and more vibrant. As we stopped eating processed food, the food became more and more delicious. As we had more time just to sit and have conversations with people, the conversations became more and more deep. Anna Lemke, who I interviewed about Dopamine Nation, talks about this in relationship to, you know, your dopamine system. that we are living in a world that overstimulates our dopamine system. Everything from highly palatable foods to fast-moving images and technology to the drugs that we use boost up, give a spike in our dopamine, which actually causes it to drop down lower to a lower point. And one of the things that she recommends is doing a dopamine detox, removing the things that are overstimulating your dopamine system. So you can do that at home. You could take a break, take a week off, take a day off, take a chunk of time off from technology. One of the things that I'm really returning back with is a commitment to have a day off of technology, Sundays, where I'm just spending my time with my family in the world. You know, it's like a little mini lazy day, which is what they call it in Plum Village, a day to reset my dopamine. So you could try that as well. One, what are you waking up to? Can you wake up to something that's more meaningful and that's more of what you want to feed your mind first thing? And two, how can you dial down the stimulation in the world around you so that you actually experience the incredible brilliance and wonder and the beauty that is already here? Look out your window. You'll see it. The third lesson from Plum Village that I want you to apply in your life is the lesson of rethinking your motivation. So there's many different meditative practices that you do on retreat at Plum Village. We do walking meditation every day, which is a slow walk through the countryside together. We do sitting meditation at 6 a.m. and sometimes in the evening. We do eating meditation, which is for the first part of the meal, you eat in silence. We read the 5 contemplations, which I'll put a link to in the show notes. It's actually something that we read in our home before we eat a meal together, where we contemplate where the food came from. We have gratitude for the food and commit to eating in a way that has the least impact on climate change as possible. And then part of eating meditation is to chew your food 30 times. Kind of hard to do that with tofu, but carrots, you can do it. And just know, you know, be aware as you're chewing your food, maybe naming your food as you put it in your mouth. This is a piece of broccoli. And then acknowledging and feeling gratitude for where your food came from. So tracing your food back to who cooked it, who farmed it, and even tracing it back to the sun and the water and the soil that it was grown in. So there's these forms of meditation that you're doing throughout your day there. The whole experience is meditative when you're at Plum Village. And one thing that is included in that form of meditation is working meditation or service meditation. So a sangha is a group of people that are a community that work together. And part of being in the sangha or the community of the monastery is to contribute to the work of the monastery. There's many different jobs you can get assigned. You can get assigned gardening service or chopping vegetables, sanitizing dishes, setting up the meditation hall. And this year, when I arrived, I was getting in line to go register for a service meditation. I ran into a friend of mine that I met last year, and she said, "Come do the toilets with me. It's the best." I was like, "You've got to be nuts." That was like the one thing that was an absolute no for me last year. I don't want to clean a public toilet. Like anything I could do to avoid cleaning a public toilet. And because she said that, I took it on as a, you know what, beginner's mind. I got to open to what's the lesson for me here at Plum Village and take it on. So that being said, my service meditation was toilet cleaning. It was probably the highlight of the whole retreat for me. Part of it was that my toilet cleaning group were a group of people who were willing to clean toilets. So you can imagine who this attracts. It's like super willing, open people that are here to be of service. And our volunteer started the service meditation with all of us singing a song together. So we'd always begin with actually more than one song. We'd sing a few songs. For those of us who are ready to get this job done with, it was like, oh my gosh, in the beginning, can we just get through the song so I can go clean the toilet and get it over with? And by the end, I started realizing, oh, it's a meditation. You're not supposed to work on getting to the end of it. You're supposed to be in it. That's why we're singing the songs. But an important part of that is that she also encouraged us to take a look at what is our motivation, our intention in cleaning the toilets. And after we had some reflection on that, she asked us to go out around as the group and share. Some people said things, "I'm here because I actually don't clean my own toilet at home and I want to get a better idea of how to clean a toilet." another person said, I'm here to clean toilets because it feels like I'm giving something really special back to this group. I'm doing something that I know that everybody wants to have a clean toilet and it'll feel good when they get one. And I want to give that to this group that gives me so much. For me, I got really connected for whatever reason to all the people that have cleaned my toilet that I have not acknowledged or even recognized in my life. So going through airports, people cleaning my toilet for me so that I could go into an airport and have a clean toilet, right? The school that my kid goes to, there's somebody that is cleaning the toilet, cleaning the bathroom so that these kids can have a sanitary bathroom. And let me tell you, after having cleaned toilets for 300 families for a week, kids are not the cleanest in the bathroom. So, but here's the thing. When you connect to intention and motivation, you're connecting to your values. So we know from psychology research that just being primed about your values changes your experience of an activity. In The Liberated Mind, Steve Hayes writes about people that are doing spinning, like exercise spinning, and how when they place note cards with people's values of the reason why they want to move their body more, they spun faster and harder than when they were just given note cards of encouragement, like, you've got this, you can do it, right? There's been studies around exercise, Megan Buterin's work, that have looked at ACT interventions versus interventions that are just about reasons why you should exercise more versus an ACT intervention that includes things like willingness and values and acceptance. And when folks are given ACT interventions, they're more likely to exercise in the long term. They're more likely to go to a gym, which was their outcome measure. But folks that were given just reasons why you should exercise more were actually exercised less over the course of the study period, right? So we know that intention and motivation and values changes our behavior. In Buddhism, there's something called the four nutriments, which are actually the four nutrients that give you energy and like nutrients for the soul and nutrients for your being. One of the nutriments is just edible food, right? Eating food gives you energy. The second nutriment is your five senses. So taking in beautiful imagery, listening to sounds of nature, smelling smells, right? You can imagine how these five senses are nutriments or nutrients to us. A third nutriment is your consciousness. You know, where is your attention being placed? Your consciousness is a nutriment. But the fourth nutriment is called your volition, which is related to your intention, your volition. So we can think about your volition, your motivation, as being a nutrient to you. And that is very much what ACT teaches in the parallel of ACT, that we know that our values motivate us. Going back to Ryan and Desi's research on self-determination theory, that's part of our autonomy and our competence and our connectedness is our values. So how you can bring this into your life is thinking about activities, especially ones that you tend to dread or ones that you have to do. Go into them first by pausing and seeing if you can find a deeper reason why you are doing this thing, a deeper volition, a deeper aspiration of why you're doing it and how you want to show up while you're doing it. When you're cleaning the toilets to honor the community that you're in and to offer them a clean toilet at night, they're going to get to go in and brush their teeth in a clean bathroom and take a shower in a clean shower. And you can imagine that it changes the way that you clean and the reason why you clean. And you're less in the drudgery of it and more in the service of it. You can think about your intention around daily household tasks, but also things like, you know, I remember when I had babies and I had a parenting coach tell me, we were in this RY class, saying that when you're changing your baby, this is one of the most important connection times that you have as a parent, because you're right over them face to face and you're looking at them in the eyes and your tone of your voice of how you're speaking to them. And you're also doing something that's quite vulnerable, right? You're changing them. You're making them all naked and cold and putting on a new diaper and you're caring for them. It's a really important bonding time. And when she told me that, it shifted how I changed my baby from moving forward, because it was sort of like this chore that I didn't want to do, especially because we did cloth diapers. So we were changing our baby like every 45 minutes, it felt like. But when I changed my boys, and I saw it as this is an important connection time, that became my aspiration, my volition, my intention was, I'm going to connect in this little moment, change the way I felt changing my babies. fast forward, now that I'm driving my kids all over the place, being in the car with a school-aged kid or a teenager is a really important connection time. And when you change it from this idea of it being a chore to an idea of what's my intention, what's my volition, what's my aspiration in doing this, it changes your experience of it. There was a study that came out that was referenced in the New York Times recently about passion and work and how we need to rethink our ideas about passion and work. Because sometimes if we put passion as sort of the goal of our work, it may end up exploiting people. Right? So you may end up working too many hours because your work becomes your whole life because it's your passion. Or people that are underpaid may be, you know, told, well, you're a teacher and this is like passionate, important work. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about getting clear on why you are doing what you're doing and finding a deeper meaning behind what you are doing. Not to exploit your services, but to make your services be more connected to your values and feel more fulfilling. So rethink your motivation. I had mentioned that this retreat was maybe even deeper for me than last year. And part of the depth of it was the teachings on interconnection and continuation. So every morning, there's something called a Dharma talk, where one of the monastics share with the community, 800 people all gathered together in a large meditation hall. And they share a talk on a teaching from Plum Village. And one of the most powerful talks that I heard was from Brother Fapung. And he held out his hand. And you could do this even as I describe this to you. And he said, look at your hand. And first, as you look at your hand, can you see the past in your hand? So as I'm looking at my hand, I can see a scar on my first finger where I cut it with a knife. I can see a scar on my thumb where I slammed my thumb in the door when I was like 8 years old. So I can see the past of my own history, but if you look even deeper, you'll see the past of your ancestors, right? I remember looking at my hand when I was a little kid and putting it next to my Aunt Mary's hand and saying, oh my gosh, we have the same hands. That's my past, right? So our ancestors are in our hands. And then if you even look more deeply in your hand and you curl your fingers over into a fist, you can see that the shape of your fingers are designed as a human to be able to make an even fist. So there's a curve of your fingers, but when you make a fist, it's even, right? Because your hand evolved. It evolved to grip things. Your hand evolved to punch things. This is the hand of a human, this evolution of this hand. So your past is in your hand. It's in every aspect of who you are. Just as you hold within your body, your past, your traumas, your losses are all stored within your nervous system and stored within your brain. And so are your ancestors. Psychological science shows this to be true. We know epigenetics. We know that how your mother ate and the stressors that your mother, your biological mother, had during her pregnancy impacts your own biology and well-being in the here and now. We know that trauma is passed on generation through epigenetics, through the changing of our DNA. So Brother Fapung had us look at our hand and say, I want you to see that the past is right here in the present. And then he also said, I want you to see that in the present, in this hand, you also hold your future. You create your future. And what I interpreted by that is what you do with your hand right now, as simple as reaching in the drawer and putting sunscreen on your body, is going to create your future 10 years down the road. What you do with your hand right now, the plastic that you may purchase, or the, you know, reaching in the drawer and getting a Ziploc bag out instead of a little bit of beeswax paper, is creating the future for our planet. I mentioned that I've loved Stephen Batchelor's book this summer. The other book that I've loved this summer is Christiana Figueres' book, The Future We Choose, and how important it is for all of us to be choosing a future that is one that is sustainable. And the actions that we take today are determining the future for our children. So here we are in the present moment. We hold the past and we hold the future in our very hand in the present moment. And you can heal both in the present. You don't have to go back to the past to heal your past. You actually heal your past by the actions that you take right here and right now, whether those are practices of self-compassion, forgiveness, understanding, being loving. And the same is true for healing the future, the actions that you take in the here and now. Stephen Hayes is well known for saying that we humans have brains that don't have delete buttons or subtract buttons. We only have add buttons. We can't erase things. We can't erase the bad stuff that has been done to us, but we can change it and we can transform it. When I interviewed Dr. Robert Waldinger, who is a director of the Harvard Health Study, he talked about how your childhood predicts your health as you age, right? The ACEs studies that have shown that having a traumatic childhood, you're going to be more likely to have health problems. He talked about having healthy relationships at 50 predict how long you're going to live and how healthy you are at 80. But he also talked about how you have the power to intervene. You have the power to change things in the present moment. You're not destined to having poor health or being stuck in a chronic mental health condition. You have the power right here and right now in the present moment. You can heal the past and the future in the present. And globally, collectively, we can work together to heal our planet in the present moment. So that's a very important teaching for me. And it was helpful when I got in that fight with my husband, right? This is the same type of fight that we've been in a million times over. I have the power right now in the present and a path to take that could change that. And coming back home, all the old patterns, all the old stuff that I was able to change at Plum Village were waiting for me to walk back into, right? It's all there, all the patterning, all the bad habits, all the things that aren't working for me in my life, which usually have to do with being overly busy and overscheduled, are there. And in the present moment, I get to change that. And there's a path. You can change it right now. So think about that for yourself. The next teaching that I want to share with you from Plum Village that I've talked about so much on this podcast, you already know it. You already live and breathe it. And we need to be reminded of it over and over again, is the teaching of our interbeing, our interconnectedness. And that teaching is closely related to the teaching of emptiness in Buddhism, or no self. And emptiness is not, or no self is not, that you are empty. It's actually you are empty of an independent self. That within you, just as I talked about with our hand, within you are parts of you that aren't you. When I did the parts work with Richard Swartz, we talked about this, right? Like what he's talking about is the leadership self is the same as this sort of empty self, this no self, that there's so many different parts that are within you that are connected to things that are outside of you. Therefore, you know, you're empty of self. To concretize this, I mentioned that every day we did mindful meditation, mindful walking meditation at Plum Village, and 800 people in a line, and you're somewhere in that line walking behind someone. And initially on the first few days of that walking meditation, I had my tendency to try and get ahead of the person that was in front of me. It just was automatic. It wasn't purposeful. It was just automatic, like kind of like wanting to pass people. And then I realized somewhere along the road of walking, what am I trying to get to? We're doing a walking meditation. And I also realized that no matter if I, you know, got in front of somebody, it was inevitable at some point in the walking meditation, someone further in front of me would stop. They had to tie their shoe, or they stopped to look at the view, or maybe someone stopped to pick a plum. It is called Plum Village because it is covered in plum trees and blackberries, and there is more fruit than you can ever imagine in this amazing place. So someone would pick a plum and eat a plum, right? And it would stop all the 700 people behind that person. What are we trying to get to? But also, we are so interconnected with each other. We were one big organism. We were one big river of people. Last year, when we went to Plum Village, we had the opportunity to spread some of Thich Nhat Hanh's ashes around Plum Village as part of a continuation ceremony for him. And our mindful walk, one of our mindful walks this year, led us back to the place where I had spread his ashes. And I went back to that same spot and stood there, recognizing that he's now in the leaves, literally in the leaves of the tree where I had placed them on the ground. He's literally in the plum fruits that the kids are eating that last year they had put the ashes on the ground as nutrients that the tree took up. And now it's transformed. We're interconnected. We don't have what they say in Plum Village is no beginning, no ending. So while I was on retreat at Plum Village, at the same time was the ACBS World Conference, Association for Contextual Behavioral Sciences, that was going on. And so when I came back, I started watching some of the videos from the conference. And one of the videos that I pulled up was a plenary with Stephen Hayes and Martine Wilkes and Dennis Turch and others. And the concept of the panel was no self, emptiness. And one of the things that Stephen Hayes said was how when we become defined by our cognitive content, like I am, we create boundaries, and we create boundaries with the ways that we interact the world with the world. When we're stuck in the sense of self as being separate, or when we're stuck in the sense of self as always being the same, like I am calm, but not always. I'm honest, but not always. I am kind, but really not always. And that this idea of no self, that it's in many different spiritual traditions, not just Buddhism. But what it does and what ACT does is we break down this narrow sense of selfing, this narrow sense of I am. I'm trying to get in front of this person who's in front of me, or this plum is separate from the person that is eating it. And this creates actually a lot of our suffering. When we feel separate, we know that 1 in 3 people feel lonely. They suffer from loneliness, and there's health, physical health, mental health consequences to loneliness. We know that we are caught up in becoming a somebody, being a somebody, striving to promote ourselves. I saw a line on Instagram, which I really liked, but then I didn't repost because then I would just be contributing to the problem Instagram, that said, followers on Instagram are like money in Monopoly. So good. Followers on Instagram are like money in Monopoly. We're in this false world of thinking that promoting ourselves and making ourselves separate and getting more things to protect ourselves is going to make us happy. But really, it's in entering the flow of our interconnectedness that actually makes us feel more safe. We know this from polyvagal theory. When we can co-regulate each other, we can co-regulate safeness. We know this as well from some of the research on psychedelics. Right? That when we actually get people into a brain state where there's no sense of self, it heals trauma. So we need to expand this sort of sense of self to include more than just us. Martine Wilkes on that ACBS panel talked about some of the work that he's doing with ACT and climate change, and how we need to look at not only our values from this personal stance, this personal self, but looking also at our values as part of a group, our extended self. And when we extend our self bigger than just what's under our skin, this tends to lead us towards more pro-social action. This is what he called the quote, ecological self, rather than just what matters to me, what matters to us. So we don't have to rush to get ahead of the person that's in front of us, but rather we can see that the person in front of us, their well-being, and the person behind us, their well-being, is our well-being. This is emptiness of independent self. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh described as interbeing. So one way you can think about interbeing for yourself is starting to think about you. And you could even just start thinking about you maybe in some of the smaller groups that you're in. We talk about our family as our family body. My husband and I are the legs. My kids are the arms. And when one part of our family body isn't well, the rest of the family body needs to go and support the family body, right? You could think about your work body. How can all members of your work body, if one person's not well, if one person needs a mental health day, if one person has too much on their plate, how could you work as a work body to support the work body? You could think about our greater interconnectedness between us and our planet. And when our planet isn't well, how we could support our planet. Or social justice issues. When people are being marginalized and oppressed, it hurts all of us, not just those that are being marginalized and oppressed. So interbeing, you are not a separate you. And when you believe that you are, you will feel alone. So I hope that you can feel part of this family body of this podcast. And the final practice from Plum Village that I want to share with you is to practice nonviolent resistance to busyness. The monastics do question and answers for the community. And during one of the question and answer periods, someone asked Sister Power. So she has the English name Sister Power. Monastics are given an English name as well as a Vietnamese name when they're ordained. And someone asked Sister Power, how do we bring this home? What is it that we should be doing when we go back home? And I loved what she said. She said, practice nonviolent resistance to busyness. Resist the mainstream of running faster and doing more. Practice determination of slowing down. The quality of our consciousness is moving fast in the wrong direction. We need skillful means to train our mind and body to slow and stop. And that was the biggest message for me. There was all these deeper messages about continuation and interconnection and emptiness and intention and paths and spiritual paths. But the simple message of slowing down and resisting the current of busyness and the current of consumption was the biggest message that I received and the biggest message that I want to pass on to my kids. Resist the urge to schedule more activities to keep up with the Joneses. Resist the urge to go on your phone or your computer to squeeze in some more sneaky work just because you feel good if you're doing more. And take a look at why you keep on doing more. Is it because it really is fulfilling to you? Or is it because it's experiential avoidance of stillness or experiential attachment to some kind of accolade that you get from being busy? And when the children asked a question, the best question that I heard asked was, why do you wear those brown robes? And one of the nuns said, because I love the color brown. And because when you wear brown robes, they can get dirty. You don't have to wash them as much, so you can be closer to the earth. So practicing nonviolent resistance to busyness, practicing that simplicity is beautiful, that you don't have to do more to be more, and that happiness is here and now in the present moment. It's available to you. So thanks for listening to this long-winded episode of Your Life in Process. I hope you found it helpful and that my musings kind of made sense somewhere along the way. Just to boil them down, 1, look for the path, not the pill. 2, wake up. What's outside your window? What's right here and right now? Enjoy it. 3, rethink your motivation, your intention, your aspiration behind what you're doing. 4, you can heal the past and care for the future in the present moment. 5, we inter are. Your well-being is my well-being. That's why I do this. And my well-being is your well-being. And 6, practice nonviolent resistance to busyness. What does that look like for you today? Come take an adult nap with me at 2 p.m. That's what I am down for these days. Lying down for like 20 minutes at 2 o'clock changes your whole afternoon. Or doing a little gentle yoga practice midday, or just taking a walk without your phone, or just sit down and have a conversation with somebody. Practice nonviolent resistance to being busy. You'll see lots of pictures of my time at Plum Village on my Instagram, and stay tuned for next week when I talk to Brother Papu, who can say all of this much more eloquently than I just did. And thank you for listening to Your Life in Process. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Life in Process. When you enter Your Life in Process, when you become psychologically flexible, you become free. Please join me as a member at yourlifeinprocess.com. And if you like this episode or think it would be helpful to somebody, please leave a review over at podchaser.com or call me at 805-457-2776. Email me at podcast@yourlifeinprocess.com. I want to thank my team, Craig, Ashley Hyatt, Elaine Schmelkin, and thank you to Ben Gold at Bell & Branch for his original music. This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only, and it's not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment.